You're listening to
Potluck.
And what is poppin', everybody? You're listening to the Good Pop Culture Club, episode 188. The most lucky of numbers, plus 100. My name is Marvin Ye, and joining me to talk about all the good pop that gets us through our days are my co-hosts, Just You, the most professional of culture. No, that's not right. Just You, the once and future professional Asian American, and Han Nguyen, the most professional of culture editors.
We could do a Freaky Friday for a day. I could be a professional culture person.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all professional Asians here.
Yes.
Whether we like it or not.
Yes.
Ain't that the truth?
Well, we made it to the end of March, and I know it's kind of like gauche to do like weather talk all the time, but doesn't it feel like we backslid into winter this past week?
Yes. What happened?
Yeah, it's gonna rain like next weekend too. Like, what the fuck?
Did you experience the hail recently?
I did not.
No hail, but like, we did get. I've been getting a lot of thunder. No lightning, just thunder. And rain,
man.
And it's been cold, and it is March, and that is rude. Because you know we only really get like 1 month. Like it's only nice and temperate and not mosquito filled for like a few weeks, and then we get like May gray, June gloom. June's like disgusting, and then it gets too hot, and then you know I'm trying to maximize the sunshine and to stave off seasonal to charge enough sunlight in my butthole to stave off the seasonal depression next winter. And it's hard when it keeps going back to winter.
Yeah, I mean totally normal behavior for a planet that's totally not dying on us.
Yeah,
so you know
I'm not having kids.
Great here.
I'm
don't
doing
watch
good.
Three body problem. Don't have any existential crises.
Oh yes. Oh, I just got breaking news. Jen Tran named the new Miss The Bachelorette.
The discourse is going to be terrible.
Oh, no.
I cannot wait. Oh,
does this mean we're going to have to do a Go Asian segment on The Bachelorette?
We're going to have to watch The Bachelorette next.
I think we're going to have to watch. This is crazy.
I've never done this like in earnest either, Marvin, so we could do it together.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
That's the power of 188.
Yeah. I feel manifest. Like that's a new, I feel like that's an entirely new podcast that we could do. Like a limited series.
Like a sub-podcast.
The Bachelorette.
This was a live, do we want this? Because that just came in my email box.
I mean, I do want this because I am curious about just the discourse. It's going to be hot mess, guys.
Oh, 100%. And it's going to be on who they cast to be her candidates, right? It's going to be terrible. I cannot fucking wait.
No.
And where is she from originally? Like, she's like a New York girl, right?
I'm reading it right now. So she's 26, sweet and compassionate. Meh. Blah, blah, blah. Dedicated her life to helping others, currently studying to become a physician's assistant. The bilingual Vietnamese beauty currently resides in Miami, ready to find love with a man who's as reliable and thoughtful as she is. When she's not studying, she loves reading, paddleboarding, and traveling whenever she has a chance.
So not just an East Coast Asian, but a Florida Asian.
Those are like two variables I do not understand. Like if she was like an OC Asian, like I would have like, that would have been more comforting. So this might be like a hot mess to watch.
Yeah, the Florida Asians, I've only been to Florida once to visit like my mom's friend. And I was just like, this doesn't compute to me.
Yeah, this is kind of like the rep switch, right? Because a vast majority of people who don't engage in, let's say, diverse content, this will be what Asians are for them.
Right? I've also just realized how fucking young they cast these people. Mm-hmm. Like no one should be looking to get married at 24. Like, if she's only 26 now, like, that's too young to get married, girl. Mm. Like,
you know,
go get your degree first. Sorry, this is like my Asian mom coming out. I was like, go finish school first. Don't worry about boys.
I mean, this is just like Love is Blind. I'm kind of like.
I mean, I've heard that the kids these days there is like a trad wife movement, right? Like there is like a back to traditional gender roles movement brewing,
which we should not be supporting, very clear, like to make that clear. But No, this is going to be so fucking fascinating / infuriating. We have to watch this.
All right.
Yeah, I hope it doesn't like really make me ill, but we shall see what the discourse brings.
I am
over
excited.
Under how deep they're going to go into the Vietnam War trauma, parental trauma, over under, Han.
Over under what, like an episode or like what's the parameters?
yeah like how I mean, how deep how real you think we're gonna get about that?
Not real. That not very real.
Who produces The Bachelorette? It's not like a Bravo show, right? It's like,
no, it's ABC.
ABC. Yeah, I feel like ABC/Disney still employs like sensitivity/diversity consultants.
Well, they have, you know, they maybe have FCC standards, but and then My real question is like, yo, we're gonna get some hot Viet guys.
Yeah,
like they have to throw in one as like a, like that's just good programming, right? You got
like if
you
this was like a
in
Discovery Zaslav joint, then totally no faith. But Disney, right, maybe.
Yeah, well, the thing is with Disney, or at least let's say with the Bachelor franchise, is like they've gone through quite a bit in the past few years. So like right after Black Lives Matter, they're like, we have our new Black Bachelor, you know. So that was a big deal. But then throughout the season, we found out like one person was, you know, had some Southern things going on in her past that was not very savory. And then she ended up being one of the finalists. So, of course, we know this watching the show, but he doesn't because it's, you know, pre-recorded. Right. And so it caused some issues that she made it that far. And
I mean,
so
that's just a risk you take. I mean, remember what happened at the Shota season of Top Chef?
Yeah. Oh, I mean,
yeah. Well, you know, Rachel Lindsay and that dude are now getting a divorce. So,
yeah, I mean, we don't really think this franchise is very good for, you know, marriages, right? Like the old people got married just because they're old, but because they're like, why not? But yeah, dang it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I'm excited that we'll be taking this journey together. I'm glad that we have this content plan going forward. to bring you the best. We're going to be the number one source of professional Asian American discourse about the Bachelorette season, whatever it is, the Asian season.
Yes, the Asian season. Every season is Asian season, but on The Bachelor, it's just this.
It'll be great. Anyways, all right, that's like a advanced, do we want this done in real time? Thank you for that, Han. It is the end of March, which means we're gonna do our monthly Asian American entertainment news roundup. Do we want this? But before we get to the rest of our news, let's find out what pop culture has been getting us through this week. And it's a very exciting week because we are bringing back our podcast within the podcast, Go Asian, with the start of the new Top Chef season. But before we get to Top Chef though, Jess, what's popping?
I am still in reality TV land because Netflix dropped season 2 of Physical 100. It starts again. Yeah. So for those of you who need a reminder, this is the South Korean reality competition where they gather 100 candidates of different physical prowesses. You know, everything from athletes to a lot of CrossFit people who do very well to, you know, to people who do yoga. We have a cosplayer this season. You know, athletes from across the board. We have an idol, retired MMA fighters, and they do a series of physical challenges to kind of see who has what is the best physique. You know, how are you defining strength and power? So they dropped the first four episodes are out. And, you know, the show was embroiled with a little scandal because the runner-up, you know, came forward and publicly stated that the last challenge was rigged. They've not addressed that at all. They're not talking about that at all. But, you know, it is Physical 100 in full force back again. Mm-hmm. I think it's still a little too early to kind of they're being very repetitive with the structure of the formats of the challenges. So the first one, in the season one, the first ones, they had a hang, right? Like hang from a rafter, essentially. Whoever hung on the longest would win. This season, they're starting off with making everyone on a treadmill, on a manual treadmill. So you're just running. But I will say, I think like some of the challenges I've seen, and then they do the death match again for like the one-on-one, like ball grab, possession, death match for Number two, they're picking their opponents the same way. And then number three is a team challenge, but it's a little different. It's a different team challenge. It's a team challenge. So they're repeating a lot of the same formats, which is a little disappointing for me. I do feel like there could have been some room for like improvement in how they designed it, so it was more equitable. But, you know, South Korea also going through, you know, going through some shit in terms of their like gender discourse right now. So I'm also not surprised. Yep. 4B movement. Like I actually think this season's challenges so far have been more inequitable than last season. Like the manual one, you know, it's about like a lot of it's gonna be about your span, like your, it's not just stamina, but like how long are your legs?
Yeah, your stride. It seems
your stride, and that's just gonna benefit like men. And then the team challenge I didn't like so much because there was an element they introduced this year where you could do direct one-on-one like fighting, like strength fighting defense, versus last year the two teams could not interact at all, right? Like you're doing the challenge independently and it's the result that counts. This year there was an element of like not just the strategy and stamina, but like they brought strength back into it. So you're like, well, of course, like having a big guy is gonna like, you know, be beneficial in the situation. So, you know, we'll see what the rest of the challenges are like. I will say the production is still amazing. The production quality, you know, like just looking at the rigging, they had like 100 manual, you know, treadmills laid out for that first challenge. And each single treadmill was framed in its own like beam square of light. And they like shut down the lights as you were eliminating. I'm like, oh wow, my God. Whoever rigged this, the lighting guy on this, the lighting team, like, amazing job. Like, congratulations. This is so dramatic and so like extra. So that element is still there. Still getting to know, you know, we're still kind of in the rounds where there's like a lot of people to know. I don't know if anyone has like quite grabbed me as much as some of the characters from last year, you know, where we had like the wrestling, you know, the wrestling captains and, you know, that like face off and MMA daddy. There is another MMA daddy, but I don't find him as charming as the previous years. So we'll see. But, you know, I'm having a good time. It's not a hard lift. Pun intended. Is it giving me body dysmorphia? Yes. Uh-huh. Am I working out more? No. Am I having a good time? Yeah. So, you know, check it out. If you like the first one, it is exactly the same. You'll like the second one.
Yeah, I've only seen the first episode so far. I'm watching it with my wife, and it does seem like the initial challenge, like, because the first season it was the hanging challenge, which is more kind of individually tailored, right? Because you're lifting your own body weight.
You're lifting your own body weight, exactly. So
whereas the treadmill just seemed unfair because obviously, you know,
like I'm sorry, if a 400 meter gold medalist runner, you know, who just happens to be a woman, like, can't break top 10, like, that's just poor design. Like, that's poor design.
I think that was like my main concern going in. It's like, will they make the challenges more equitable? Because that's what made the first season so exciting was, like, certain events, like, your body type, and you can use your body type and your kind of individual strength to your advantage, so that brute strength, while a viable strategy, isn't the only strategy, right? I think that's what made the first season so exciting.
I don't think the way they are designing these challenges don't seem like they're very concerned with those critiques from season one, which again, I'm like, maybe that's their prerogative. Like, they don't care about, like, you know, trying to even the playing field. You know, maybe that's just the cultural bias that, you know, that also exists here in this country and many other countries. But it just also just makes for a less interesting game overall, like outside of like principle or morals or your values. It's just like, it's not interesting if you're like, oh, we're going to like just value like brute strength over like stamina or even strategy or like teamwork, you know what I mean? Like, you're just gonna give it to the guy who can throw the most or something. It's like, okay,
because the show itself is like, they use a lot of death game aesthetics, right? And the fun of watching a death game is seeing the underdog team pull off victories through like through strategy, right? And if you don't have that layer, if it's just like, okay, like we all like, we're just marking time until
or who has like mental fortitude, right? Like, one of my favorite challenges in the first is when they just have to like hold their like like a percentage of their own body weight. And then it's like, oh, like everyone has the same ratio. Like it's mm-hmm. it's proportionally the same. And it's just like, who can suffer the most and pull through? You know what I mean? Like that's interesting to me. But you know, it's still, we'll see. We have a few more episodes. I did really like some of the challenges, like the Greek myth challenges they did last time. So I'm like, what theme are they going to go with this time? It'll be interesting to watch. Yeah. And hopefully this one is not rigged.
So just to confirm, 4 episodes in, no one's really jumping out as like an interesting character, because that was also one of the strengths of the first season, was like by episode 3 or 4, you had like, you're like 4 people you want to root for, like wrestler lady, strongman dude, like the really like the skeleton athlete. Like, is there anybody that you're like rooting for?
There's some folks I like, but I don't think the show is spending necessarily spending time with people I like, and the people they are spending a lot of time with, which, you know, is always a gamble because you don't know if they're going to make it to the end. And then like last season, you're like, who are these last 2 people? I do not remember them, which is, you know, just kind of the course for reality TV and editing. But it's there. They don't pop out to me quite as much as before. And I don't know if that's just a. Yeah, who knows? I don't know what their casting process is like. I don't know if like this they may have gotten more interest this year because, you know, it was such success the first year.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, that first season lighting the bottle. So we'll see if this one recaptures it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's, you know, that's what I'm watching. But Marvin, what's popping with you?
Yeah. What's popping with me is welcome to the Hyeonam-dong Bookshop, which is a book by Hwang-bo Roem. Translated by Shanna Tan, which is this month's Books and Boba Book Club pick. So I've been furiously reading it in order to be ready for our book club discussion podcast that's releasing later this week. It is about a woman who is so burnt out by her career and life that she leaves her marriage, quits her job, and moves out to a small neighborhood of Seoul in order to open a bookstore. So the story follows her journey, as well as the stories of her employees and customers, as we learn what goes into not only running an independent bookstore, but also what it takes to keep one open in today's modern age. So yeah, it's a story about this bookstore, its community, and it's a pretty chill time.
I love that for you. I love how this is like not some depressing like child soldier like death game thing, Marvin.
I mean, that's not good, to say there's you. No existential dread in this book. There is a chapter that depicts like a book club discussion where a group of multi-generational book club members discuss the impacts and effects that capitalism and Korean work culture has had on their lives. So definitely a lot of like millennial ennui in this book. I mean, it's essentially the reason why this woman moves out and quits her job and starts over anyways. And, you know, it's when I first heard about this book, I thought it would be more of like, you know, there's a certain genre of Japanese novel, which is just vignettes of a business where people come mm-hmm. in and resolve their yeah. personal issues, right? Kind of in the vein of like Tokyo Midnight Diner, or there's a story that we've read before on Books and Boba about a magical coffee shops where if you sit in a specific seat, you can go back in time and revisit an important moment yes. of your life.
I have that on my Hoopla right now. Shout out LA County Library.
Yeah, so it's a much more grounded story than those. But I love that it's a story about how a bookstore can act as a hub for community and help people find the things that they're missing that modern society does not provide them with. And it's a pretty chill read. Nothing super dramatic happens. There's some light romance, but you really do come to care about all of the various employees and customers and partners of this bookstore. And yeah, I had a really great time reading it.
It's on my list. I will get to it, I promise.
Yeah, totally recommend it. But yeah, that's what's popping for me. Han, I'm really excited about what's popping for you, because mm-hmm. what's popping for you is the launch of our new season of our podcast within the podcast Go Asian, where we recap the new season of Top Chef that just started, specifically to follow our new batch of Asian chefs as they compete for the title of Top Chef. So, yeah. Han, what's popping?
Top Chef is back. Yay. So Top Chef is back after last season's global adventure. We are now stateside. We're domestic again, but we have a new host. As we have mentioned before, Padma, that was her last season. So we have introduced former champion Kristen Kish. She is the new host. She towers above the other two, Gail and Tom, which, you know, is appropriate. And yeah, and it's set in Wisconsin. So there's a lot going on. What I like about it so far, the first episode had a lot going for it. And it's basically they tested sort of basic chops. Basically, each chef chose one thing that people mess up all the time. So Kristen chose soup. Gail chose pasta. And then Tom chose roast chicken. And they split all the contestants up to serve each of those courses. Mistakes were made. Some things were just awful. But, you know, there are a lot of promising things. I think I like the format of it. Also, I'm just going to spoil, but like at the very end, they also took the bottom three from one loser in each category, soup, chicken, and pasta. And then they made them do another cook-off. So against
reverse
each other.
Quick fire.
Yeah, it was like a reverse quick fire where they just did it right in the moment and they used the ingredients from the leftovers from the just the previous competition. So I thought that was uniquely cruel. Other unique cruel things this season, but makes sense, is that the there are no more immunities from quick fire challenges, because you know what we've seen what happened there. Is you win a quick fire, you get immunity, and then you like slack off in the elimination challenge, and that might even include if you're on part of a team, and that sucks. So this time, basically, if you get immunity, it would be if you won an immunity challenge, elimination challenge, and that would carry over for the next episode. So you could probably just pile on immunity after immunity after immunity if you wanted to, if those are on offer, but. For insensitive for the fire, it's just tons of money, and that worked for most of the contestants.
I'm not sure if I like the idea of the first challenge. I'm not sure it's mm-hmm. it reminded me of my feelings for the first episode of Physical 100, which was it's a very uneven challenge, right? Because they're not all playing the same playing field. They're all given like a different thing that they're supposed to be judged on. For a first challenge, you want to see kind of everyone showing off their skills, right? What they can bring to the table.
I think is that what you're trying to say is like you want all the other factors to be controlled. So like it's the chef and their ability and their like voice that like comes out instead of like a luck of a draw. Like I'm well uniquely suited. Like, oh, I do pasta all the time. So like this is great. But like, you know, like there's some surprises, like the woman who was like really freaking out about making pasta, like ended up killing pasta.
That was great. I kind of feel like this felt like it would have been a great either mid-season challenge or even like a quick fire. But as like the first elimination challenge of the season, I don't know. I would have wanted to see like a challenge that was a little bit more balanced for the first one, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it showed. Here's the thing. I will also defend their weird reverse quickfire challenge, too, because I think it did actually show who had the chops. The person who left is the one that I think from the very beginning you wanted to leave, right, Marvin?
Oh, well, my God. Thank God.
Yeah.
He was the most annoying. But also, when I watched him cook, I was like, oh, you are chaotic and you actually don't have a lot. I think he relies on a little bit of randomness and chaos for his, you know, unique special sauce.
He was the most early season Top Chef contestant.
Yeah,
I've seen in a while, right?
Yeah, I honestly don't know how he made it to the show. But so besides the woman who did the pasta, who I'm almost always gunning for the woman of color who comes from Houston. Her name is Michelle, so that was great. But
there,
who are any of us rooting for? Any other
Well, I guess this is where we can go into our Go-Asians for the season, right? Because we have three. We have three. We have Kenny Nguyen, who is the chef at Expat in Atlanta. We have Rasika Venkatesa, who was formerly the chef at Marad, which was a Michelin star Moroccan place in San Francisco. And now is, I think she's a either a personal chef or in between jobs based in New York. And then we have Kalina Bliss, who is the executive chef at Cindy's Rooftop in Chicago, who is a Korean adoptee from the Midwest.
Like Kristen Kish.
Yeah. I gotta say, not the best showing from our Asians in this first episode, both in terms of cooking skill and character.
I will, at this point, somewhat defend Kenny. The reason why he was in the bottom was not his ability, but yes, bad timing. You know, he didn't get both the dark and the white meat on the plate. And I fully ding him for that. But, you know, he played it slightly safe in the reverse quickfire, you know, elimination thing. But I think he showed that he knew his flavors. He had all that. He was just, you know, like in a rush. So I think, and also the idea that he made a pho sauce.
That sounded good.
Yeah.
Chicken sounds pretty bomb, actually.
Delightful.
Yeah.
In general, it sounds like he knows what he's doing. It's all his food, like, sounds like I'd like to actually eat at his restaurant. So right now I'm kind of like, okay, you learned your lesson early on.
Yeah, so, hopefully time management gets better. Because sometimes it keys in, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
So you never know. I think Rasika, we didn't see much from her.
Right.
No, very, very, like, you know, not great, you know, didn't win her round, but like, I like her cheekiness, like the way she was describing her food. I was like, oh, you're going to take like this very traditional food, but like you're going to do something cheeky, like add beef to it, which is like, oh, it's like, you know, that's like Jewish people who cook, like, you know, do Jewish favorites of like pork or bacon. I'm like, I like the vibe. I think she's good energy. I hope she does well in the future runs.
Yeah. And there's no doubt all of these chefs are insanely talented, right? It's like kind of like professional football, which is like everyone here is a good chef. That's why they're on this show. But when asked to perform at this level with these constraints, like, you know, some people can't hang as much and some people can't think as fast, right? So it'll come down to whether or not they can get in the zone, because that's what makes a good competitor in this competition. So, yeah, I mean, excited to see where she goes as well. And then we have Kalina, who I don't necessarily remember what she made, but I do remember things that she said.
Oh, she's embarrassing. Let's be real. She was a little embarrassing. And I'm just like, girl, like,
this is.
It's like, I can tell you were adopted. You did not clock the other Asians in the room. You didn't even consider the South Asian girl an Asian person. Like, come on. Yeah. Like, that's an inside thought.
Yeah. So basically on the show, she's like, I'm the only Asian. And then, you know, Kenny and Rasika are
Everyone hello. Was like, no, like, there's Rasika. And Kenny's like, and Kenny was like very gritty. He's like, I know I don't look it, but like, actually Asian.
Yes.
But he kind of does. And the thing is, like,
We could clock it.
I would also say, you know, maybe Kalina, maybe the least Asian of these people. So,
yeah. I mean, Dan makes Dan noodles. Dan from Wisconsin has a Chinese restaurant.
Can we bring him up? Like,
please.
Can we bring him up, please? Because it's one thing if he says, I love Chinese food and I learned. But also, I think he still needs to acknowledge that this is American Chinese food he knows. But then also, he needs to just change his language a little bit. Because like when he was describing his dish, he's like, well, I decided to make it, but I decided to put a little bit of something of myself in there. So there's the Chinese elements. I was just like, don't say that you put...
The verbiage, the diction, the word choice could be a little better.
Yeah, he needs to just say, I put in the flavors that I love and I studied. Because there's that other white lady who went to school for Japanese cuisine. And I'm like, you can learn what you want, but like, don't call it like me or mine. You know, it's just weird.
Again, like, it feels like a throwback from those early Top Chef seasons where, like, you had, like, the white chef who makes Asian food and it's, like, their entire identity, right?
Oh, my God.
Oh, the white guy who's obsessed with Vietnamese.
Yeah, and he had a Vietnamese boyfriend. Dudes.
Yeah, that was cringy.
That season was amazing because it was so bad because I think he also was trying to give advice on how to make Vietnamese food and it was such bad advice. You know what I thought was interesting is because last season was the first season we were like, oh my God, we were seeing people Top Chef all over the world. But this season we got a Frenchman and his name is Kevin.
but apparently he competed before on Top Chef. So I guess France, Top Chef France, because he also was kind of unaware. He's like, I've never shopped for my own ingredients before. I'm really enjoying it.
So. I want to see that season of like French people saying, and this is Kevin, Je m'appelle Kevin. Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like every time I was like trying to catch his name, I was like, oh, it's Kevin.
Oh, it's it's just Kevin. Oh, you know what? Good for you, Kevin.
Yeah. I allow it.
But back to Kalina. Yeah, it was definitely like, oh, like.
That was cringe.
There's certainly like, and, you know, everyone's at a different level of self-actualization as an Asian American. So, like, you know, sometimes there is a bit of internalized East Asian privilege, especially people who don't, like, think about how Asia big. Right.
Well,
wow, so eloquent, Marvin. I love it. Asia big.
I mean, here's something that was interesting, because I know, like, this is something that I've noticed is an ongoing thing, and this is not even an East versus whatever Asian, but it's you know, people outside of being Asian not understanding the differences between East, Southeast, South Asians. And one of the differences I noticed was someone was putting, like, categorizing Taiwan as Southeast. And I was like, I see what you're doing here. Like, geographically, maybe you could almost, I was like, what?
When people are like, oh, yes, East Asia, Japan, Korea, China, Mongolia. And I'm like, one of these things is not like the other.
Right. Also, Mongolia is like in the middle of things, right? Like of
it's
Southeast
technically
Asia.
Central Asia. That's like the stands. Yeah. Mongolia. Yeah.
Yeah. Cultural, like there's cultural ties that like make more sense to group in certain places that, you know, like you just can't go off geography.
Right.
So,
just like Hong Kong is not considered Southeast Asian. Sorry. Just
no.
Yeah.
But anyway. I mean,
at the bottom of all, there's a lot of just like Han Chinese privilege talking there too, you know? Like
sorry. My people kinda suck. We're kind of a lot.
Yep. I mean, I think a lot of different Asian groups have sucked in the past. So Chinese more, but
but yeah. You know, I mean,
anyway,
maybe she just don't know no better, right? Like,
no, she does not. Yeah, yeah.
That, and hopefully, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to cringe every time she opens her mouth, but also, they don't really talk a lot about, like, cultural identity isn't, like, it's on the plate usually. It's not, like, in conversation, right?
Or a lot of times they find it in the journey, right? Like, they end up, they come in cooking, like, I do Thai, I do, like, it's like Dawn from... a few seasons ago was like working at Uchi. Like she was she worked at a Japanese restaurant.
That's fine.
And you know, one of the other contestants was like working in like a Southeast Asian restaurant. And then they're like, oh, like this is my only, but I have a chance to cook like my food and like my family's food. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, this is great. And so successful. Even like, you know,
even
didn't
Kristen
Gregory
was like,
yeah. Well, no, like Gregory came in
to search for Korean food, right?
Yeah, and Gregory didn't start off in his season cooking like Haitian food. Mm-hmm. Like, and usually, like that's his journey. So we'll see. Let's hope no one embarrasses us. Let's see, you know. Faith in the journey.
But to answer your earlier question, I think out of our three Asians so far, I am rooting for Kenny. I think he, at the very least, I don't hate him right now.
And he's apparently from Philly. I just love a Philly person. Like no matter what race. Philly people just tickle me.
And it's not just that he's Vietnamese, but I like the way he describes the flavors because he was like a lot of funkiness and blah blah blah. And I was like, yes, you understand that these are very strong flavors and you need to learn how to balance them and stuff like that. So so far everything except for that really hideous mistake, you know, I'm cool with.
Yeah.
So,
and at the very least, I do want to eat his pho roast chicken.
Right.
That sounds delightful.
It sounds so good. and you know, we'll see more about the other two. It's the first episode. I'm willing for them to have a character arc, you know? So, yeah.
Top Chef's back. Excited to continue on this journey with y'all. Mm-hmm. We'll see if this is the season where we stop following it halfway through because all the Asians are gone.
Oh,
Well, Kirsten Kish will always be there. So.
That's true.
Yeah, we'll
that's
see.
That's the true goal Asian of this season.
I mean, we got spoiled like two seasons back with like, what, five or six people?
I mean, we got two Houston. Straight seasons of Buddha, so, you know.
Yeah, it's fine. We can let some other people have it for a bit.
I enjoy Buddha. I love teachers' pets.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's what's popping for this week. That's what's going to be popping for the next, what, 10 weeks?
Sure.
So excited. Top Chef season back in action.
Love that for us. Woo!
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, it's time for our monthly entertainment news roundup. Do we want this? So stick around.
Hello, I'm Phil Yu, and I'm the host of All the Asians on Star Trek, the podcast in which I interview all the Asians on Star Trek. I'm talking to actors, writers, directors, stunt people, background extras. You know, all the Asians on Star Trek. Find out more at alltheasiansonstartrek.com. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Live long and prosper.
Hey, Brian, did you go to Saturday school as a kid?
I sure did. Did you?
Totally.
Well, at our podcast, Saturday School, we don't teach a language, but we pass along the culture that we do know.
And that's Asian American pop culture.
Ada's a journalist, and I'm a professor and film festival programmer.
We've watched a lot of great Asian American movies, and we want you to watch them too. Come listen to us as we look back at the pioneering films that have led us to today.
And welcome back to the Good Pop Culture Club. It is time for our monthly Asian American entertainment news roundup. Do we want this? Where we go around to talk about what's going on in the world of media and entertainment and ask ourselves, do we really want this? I'm going to count that first Bachelorette news as your first story. So we're going to start this segment off with Jess. What's going on?
You know, keeping in with the love theme, it was just announced that Bridgerton actress and Ooh. Human goddess Simone Ashley will be starring in a new Prime Video rom-com called Picture This Ooh. With hero Phineas Tiffin, who I did not know who this man Ooh. Was. Sorry to this man. He is the little Portuguese man from Love Interest in The Woman King. That is my best reference.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Okay.
I was like, you know what? You were charmed. You know, you were not the point of that movie. You were a little useless, but you were like perfectly like cherub face cute. I will say this Hollywood Reporter article did him mad dirty because that's not a good picture of him.
No.
And Simone Ashley is like fucking glowing right? as if she can do anything else. But the movie's cast also includes Phil Dunster from Ted Lasso. Our favorite, a good pop favorite, Nikesh Patel. I like how his credit is London Has Fallen and what? Not like any of the other amazing right? fucking rom-coms he's been in.
Yes, seriously.
Adil Ray, Sundu V, Anushka Chadha, Kulvinder Gur, and Luke Featherston. And funny enough, it is actually a remake of Five Blind Dates, which we covered, that was written by Shuang Hu and Nathan Rummels Park. But this is going to be set in, I assume, you know, in London, and it's going to be, you know, more involved with the South Asian community. So do we want this?
Yeah, I didn't know about the Five Blind Dates connection there.
Right.
I've never heard of like an adaptation this fast of like.
It's kind of smart, though, right? Like, this is a good concept and you can really like plug and play like different communities, right. but different actors. You get a really fun cast. So, you know, it's basically the synopsis is that Hollywood Reporter is giving is single and without a man on the horizon. Pia Ashley runs a failing photo studio in London with her best friend. As her sister prepares to get married and her mother Lakshmi urges the resolutely independent Pia to partner up, a spiritual guru predicts she will meet the love of her life among the next five dates she goes on. So, you know,
yeah, so instead of like a failing tea store, it's a failing photography studio.
Photo store. But you know, like another common thread in Asian cultures is we love our fucking superstitious, like, you know, astrologer, shaman, you know, insert like spiritual figure here. Like that is a very, you know, I will say like immigrant world carryover that I think we can relate to. And I will, my only qualm is that, you know, the way that this is framed, it's obvious, you know, I will assume that Simone Ashley ends up with this boy from
I know. And I really wanted to be Nicholas Patel, but I feel like he's playing
character, right? Why would you cast the two hottest people, like, walking this earth and, like, working in film and not let them get together? It's rude.
Do you think he plays the Desmond role?
Yeah. Probably. Or the good, like, the good one, like the John one. Yeah.
The one that's in love with the mom.
No.
Yeah, because he is on paper like perfect, right? Like a handsome brown boy. Like he probably has like the good family and everything. But you know what's the catch? In love with the mom.
Yeah.
I can see. But, yeah. Go.
Oh, I was about to say. As sort of corny as that film was, I could see it as a great blueprint. And with this cast already, I'm just really excited. It sounds like it could be something good.
I mean, it's just a good template for getting a lot of hot people.
Hot guys, right?
In one film, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But my only other thing is, like, again, no offense to this man. He's very cute, but like he's cute. Like he looks very young to play opposite Simone Ashley. Like he feels like a little like boyish.
Perhaps he could grow a beard.
But, like, I don't know if that's going to help. Like, we know Simone Ashley can bring the heat. Like, her and Jonathan Bailey in Bridgerton were, like, phenomenal. Like some of the horniest, like, acting, you know. So, like, if that's the level we know she can get when, like, casted well against, you know, opposite love interest. So, he's 24. That's a little, like... That feels a little young. It might look a little young. Can he bring that horniness to? I guess that's not this kind of movie, but you know, can the under tension of that horniness, does it exist? But we'll see. I will be watching.
Yes, we will probably watch it for this if we're still doing a podcast, you know, forever.
I'm dropping in a picture of him with some scruff, and you can tell me what you think.
Okay.
Marvin is collecting very important data. He's giving us pictures of Hero Tiffin. Okay, like a little bit. Just that scruff does help, but it's like not my vibe.
Well, he's
that's personal preference. So
I think it is an odd pairing, but you know, I'll put it on faith that maybe they have amazing chemistry or something. Whatever.
I mean, Simone actually can have chemistry with anybody.
That's true.
That is true. She is beautiful and amazing and charming and glowing. And I love her and I want her to be in everything. But yeah, like, let's keep the rom-com trend going, y'all. Let's
He plays soccer, so maybe he'll have some good thigh moments.
Okay. Also, I hope, just, you know, on my bias thing, I hope Nathan fucking gets paid for this, because if they're using his IP,
I hope
Shuang and Nathan are getting fucking paid for this and it becomes a franchise and they get fucking paid again.
Yeah.
So
remake it elsewhere. Come on. Do it.
It's going to be new Pride and Prejudice.
The modern.
I'm not mad at that.
You could
really do it.
I'll
take one in the 626. I'll take one in like feudal Japan. I don't know. Yeah. Like, we could play with it.
Yeah. I think it'd be fun.
Move over, Seven Samurai. It's time for 5 blind dates. All right. I guess on a similar vibe spectrum to that, Deadline announced a new action film directed by George Huang, starring Luke Evans, our favorite Sun Kang, and Gui Lun Mei, called Weekend in Taipei. The story is about John Lawler, a pit bull-like DEA agent, married to his job. There's not a bad guy he can't stop and nothing he won't sacrifice to close out a case. As well as Joey Kwong, a top transporter in Taipei, fast driving and fast thinking, difficult to pin down and impossible to catch. The two of them weren't supposed to fall in love, but fate brought them together before forces of crime and corruption tore them apart. Now, 15 years later, fate puts Joey and John on a collision course during a weekend in Taipei, and the two will discover that the only thing harder than falling in love is falling back in love. Do we want this?
it's a transporter reboot, right? It's transporter reboot in Taiwan.
Yeah, I think it does give very much like that era of like Fast and Furious type like high octane car action. I just in 2024, I would be way more interested in this project if Luke Evans and Sun Kang's roles were switched. Maybe
there's some there's some good potential, you know, some potential green flags they have in a Chinese director or Chinese. I'm not sure the background, but George Huang is directing. I was like, okay, that's progress. Cause you know, back in the day it would have been a white guy.
It would have been Luc Besson.
Yes. And you know, there's, I'm always open to a new potential action franchise that's just dumb and fun, right? Like, this could be the new John Wick, right? John Wick didn't seem very impressive at first go. This could be maybe the new Fast and Furious. I'm sure they're hoping it is too. I like Luke Evans. Mm-hmm. Do I wish it was not hinged on a relationship between like a white dude and an Asian woman? Of course.
At the same time, though, thinking about it now, I do kind of dig action persuasion, which is what this is giving me.
You're pulling out the Austin now.
Right? It is about it's a second chance romance in an action film, which has potential.
I'm going to need a lot.
Depends on the direction. Yeah, depends on the direction. An action romance is a pretty high bar to get right. Because I think usually people who are really good at one are not good at the other. I think the romance directors are probably... I actually think I'd rather give a romance director an action film than vice versa. Because cringy action is not as bad as cringy romance. Especially with these two archetypes. But you know, we'll see, and maybe it'll be like, watch, this is, you know, they spend like $5 million on this and makes like 50, and then we're gonna get like Weekend in Bangkok, Weekend in XYZ. I can see the franchise now. And you know, yeah, Luke Evans is not offensive to me. I'm not like a super stan, but he's fine. Maybe he can tap into that like that weird mysterious energy that like gay men have, where they're really good at having like romance, like on-screen romances a la Jonathan Bailey. Maybe I think Luke Evans can have that in him. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, my wildest dream, maybe the love interest is actually Sun Kang. That's the twist. Would love that.
Ooh.
So, you know, open, but part of me still kind of wishes with a title like that, that it was just like Weekend in Bernie's, but like in Taiwan.
Who gets to play the dead person?
Luke Evans.
Just cart around the white guys just so you have access to stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tentative, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not going to say no to a dumb car action film. And I do like the people. I do like a Sun Kang project. So, yeah, I guess, up for further review. But right now, it's like, I'm not sure if I want this, but it could be interesting.
I am cautious about this. I'm not going to say no, but I'm not going to say yes yet, quite yet.
All right. Moving on. Han, what's our next story?
So this is a combo story because, you know, Netflix, Netflix giveth and it taketh away at the same time. So this month we got the 1-2 punch of Avatar: The Last Airbender got renewed for 2 whole seasons. And it was blah, 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 blah. And that so it got renewed for 2 whole seasons with the 3rd season being its last. So we know the full run. It's going to have a conclusion. People's hearts will not be broken necessarily by, you know, something getting cut short, you know. And then, speaking of, The Brother's Son got canceled by Netflix after its first season. So, do we want this?
I mean, it's a twofer, right? It's like, yes, right, and right? No. I'm glad that Avatar is getting the full season. I feel like, I want to say that might have been like the deal, right? Having like the Avatar studio put their project on Netflix. Netflix had to commit to all 3 seasons, which is the power that Avatar has, which is power that Brother Sun does not have. Because by all accounts, it was pretty successful, right? Like our misgivings aside, like everyone I talked to about that show really liked it.
I think it was just understanding like what it was about and seeing the potential in it. I think knowing, you know, running into the cast and stuff like that also helped. They were very charming.
and, you know, like the lead Justin was actually cooking and doing live, you know, like Instagram lives while cooking and doing stuff like that. And Sam is a known, you know, influencer. So he was great at creating content. And I could just see like where this family could go. And Michelle Yeoh was really heartbroken too when she found out the news and posted something really sad. And
I mean, if Michelle Yeoh's willing to do something, just like you let her do it. It's Michelle Yeoh, right? Like, if this show cannot cost that much. Like, I'm gonna be real. Mm-hmm. Like, compare it to like, you know, Avatar, which is very expensive because of all the VFX, mm-hmm. and you know they're shooting like you're shooting 6 to 6. I know how much it takes to rent out Golden Soup. It's not that much. Yes. My family can do it. Netflix can do it. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah. It was one of those things where I do understand the Netflix model. It's like, if something hits number one for a while, we're good. And it was like, and so Avatar was number one around the world. And so that was kind of undeniable. But I did notice that didn't stay up there that long. And it's just because whoever is going to watch it, binge it. Whereas Brother Son, I don't think ever made it to number one, but it stayed in the top 10 for a few weeks. So I thought that was because it was a lot of good word of mouth discovery. So I thought that was actually a really great indicator that it had potential and that people were finding it. And that's not something that happens for something where, you know, the main photo on your homepage or whatever, the Netflix homepage, isn't necessarily a recognizable face, because other than the Michelle Yeoh, most of the people they were showing were just like people you'd never met before. So I thought that was a testament to how like it had, you know, this kind of fun element that people were drawn in by. So I'm kind of sad about that. I think it definitely could have grown into something. I was going to recommend it to my mom, and now I'm like, eh. So.
I mean, the first season does end, like, does close the loop a little bit, right?
Yeah, sure. And at least we have that, you know, sure. It's not like a total cliffhanger, like, you know, cut to the chest, stab in the heart. But it's just like, you know, there was, like, also some, like, really hot people in that show. It's like, where are we going to see the hot people now?
Well, I know Sam is going to be in a bunch more projects going forward. Like, he's really...
Yes. Yeah.
Channeling, like taking advantage of his moment. I don't know. I mean, Michelle Yeoh will be fine, right? Yes. Michelle Yeoh will be Michelle
Yeoh.
Will
she? Yes, of course.
I wonder, well, I mean, Justin was, in my opinion, the strongest part of that show.
Yes.
So I'm hoping he'll land on his feet as well.
Yeah, I think they saw the potential in him for his action, and also people saw him shirtless and stuff. So I think he was a great actor too. So there's a lot to recommend to him. It's just, I hope he doesn't rush into the first thing, but like maybe take some time and gets a good project as his follow up.
I mean, I know this has happened to shows everywhere, but it does extra suck when it's like, yeah, like the Asian show only gets like one season. Right?
And it was decent. That's the thing. It's like, it wasn't a perfect show, but there are also a lot of imperfect shows that do great on Netflix. Sorry, Outer Banks, and you know, all those other shows, but yeah,
Virgin River is like on season 6. Like, there's a Virgin River universe.
Yeah, oh, totally. I've watched like maybe 3 or 4 of those seasons, and it's just you know, for work. And I was just like, if Virgin River can continue, this one was way more fun than that. So yeah, it was a shame. Yeah. And I kind of had hopes that maybe another network would pick it up, but there was really no mobilization for that. So.
That being said, I'm glad that Avatar, we're going to see it to completion. I know that the creators have their differences with the production, but I do hope that this will pave the way to like a Korra adaptation.
It's probably being discussed right now. So maybe it will be dependent on like what season 2 does when it starts.
Yeah, or what the deal is, because you know, at the end of the day, it's still a Nickelodeon property and the original creators still probably retain some rights to them. So, and you know, they didn't part on the best ways, so we'll see. But a Korra adaptation would be pretty cool, but also like significantly worse to deal with bitches, because that's because we're talking then about putting a young woman of color, like a darker skinned woman of color, ideally a darker indigenous woman in the lead role. And honestly, like, the the fan base of the Avatar, the haters are like pretty gnarly. Like, I'm not even seeking them out, like, because, you know, like, why would you bother? But like, even like very passively, just like being a part of it, like, I'm seeing just a small percent of the terrifying comments about these literal children, mm-hmm. like, just obscene shit, like all. And again, I don't even like kids, but like, I'm like, you are literally like saying this awful stuff about a 14-year-old. Like, mm-hmm. get your head out of your ass and go touch some grass and get some therapy, because like, nothing this 14-year-old did warrants that much like vitriol from you. So like, get your check, stay off the internet, kids. And so yeah, we'll see.
Yeah,
hopefully, maybe. And like, oh dude, like, people already hate Korra as an animated show because, you know, the world can't handle difficult female protagonists. So also, maybe I, like, don't want a Korra.
Maybe more explicit. Yeah, and like more explicit, like,
she's gay. Subjects. Like, she's gay. Yeah, yeah, she's gay, think... and she's difficult, and she's bratty, and she's like a little, like, yeah, like that just,
and yeah,
bad time for the actress.
I think that'll be tough. At the same time, like, from what I know of that series, the themes that show hits are more stuff that I'm interested in my stories, and I've heard that they notoriously like fumble the bag on that series, right? In terms of like narrative structure.
Yeah, so maybe there's a chance to, like, you know, rewrite some of those wrongs, but it is going to be the cost of, I think, some people like actually working on the show. So I don't know if anyone deserves that or if we want that.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
We'll see. All right. Jess, what's your next story?
Speaking of adaptations, new story about a new adaptation coming. I have actually never heard of this book, but it sounds interesting. The acclaimed nonfiction book, The Peking Express, is set for a movie adaptation. And this, oh my God, guys, this story has everything. The ambassador to China, Beijing, a train, a heist, hostages, Mao Zedong. What? But yes, this is apparently a nonfiction book about a real life train heist that they are planning to adapt into a feature film with filmmaker Da Ming Chen and producer Chris Lee, formerly of TriStar Columbia. It is based off a famous train incident in 1923 when Chinese bandits raided a luxury express train bound for Beijing and took over 300 international hostages for leading up to a 6-week geopolitical showdown. And when I tell you, I can't even read to you the entire plot because it literally has everything I mentioned before. Mao Zedong, hostage, warlord, rebel, robbing a train, Marlene Dietrich. There's a Hemingway-esque adventurer white man, of course. And again, this is going to be a China-US co-production, which, you know, in the past has not produced great things, but maybe this will be the one that cracks the code. So do we want this?
Yeah, I mean, I love a good heist. And 1920s China, especially 1920s Shanghai, is just, I love those aesthetics. I love those vibes. And it is a very volatile time in Chinese history, right? Like, the Civil War is heating up. Sun Yat-sen either is dying or is about to die. And so there's a lot of political upheaval and uncertainty, which makes for a really great setting for like a thriller.
I think the actual event is super interesting. And, you know, the real event actually inspired, as this article mentions, a movie in the 20s called The Shanghai Express, starring Marlene Dietrich and Anna May Wong. I just find it so interesting about like what this entails, like the politics of this. Who is going to be in this movie? Because like, are they going to try to do, are they going to learn from the lessons of the Great Wall and know that you don't like, and try to like, are they going to try to, I think, erroneously force a Matt Damon on us again? Or are they going to, like, maybe be a little brave, be a little interesting, and pull a... Mm-hmm. I can't believe I'm saying this. I'll give it credit where credit is due. Are they going to pull a Shang-Chi? And are they going to get someone like fucking Tony Leung or Andy Lau, who this director has worked with, you know, and, you know, bring them to a true audience, a global audience in an American Western film, what language is it going to be? That are they going to be brave and are they going to do this in mostly Chinese? I think that would be fucking cool. You know, like, I think the world has changed. I think movie going has changed a lot since Great Wall. If people are brave enough, because I think it would be so cool to get like Andy Lau, Tony Leung, those guys, those like OGs in a big like American film, but in like Mandarin, where like the full breadth of their talent can be shown and appreciated. You know, the heist are younger. Like, are we going to get some new talent? Is it going to be Chinese national talent? Is it going to be American talent? There's a lot of, and then like, you know, a lot of these themes is like, oh, the Chinese government is down for this. So I assume we're going to get a version of this that is pro CCP and pro Mao, because again, Mao somehow factors into all of this. Mm-hmm. But also, like, you know, it's a book written by like a white guy. So I was like, oh, how are those like tensions and perspectives going to play out? It's very interesting.
Yeah. And you know, we're talking 1920s Shanghai. Shanghai itself at this point is kind of carved up by a lot of foreign powers. So there are openings for inserting like European / white people into the story as well. Shanghai is a very international city at this point. And I mean, when we're talking 1920s China, 1920s Shanghai, what I'm most excited about are the looks. It's going to be a very...
The looks are good, very glamorous. Yeah. You know, I will say the thing that does worry me is that it looks like the book is told and heroicizes one of these foreign correspondents who was on the train, a John B. Powell. So, you know, I can see how they could very easily Matt Damon this. Honestly, it would be pretty funny if they got Matt Damon to play this guy. It wouldn't be a no for me at that point. Like, at that point, like, you almost kind of have to watch the pun intended train wreck.
What if they get Brad Pitt again? And this is just 1920s bullet train.
I mean, like, you know, I don't have a forgetful memory. And I know Brad Pitt still should be canceled because he's an abusive asshole. So I would not like Brad Pitt in this movie. But I am interested to see if this plays out, what scale it will play out to, like how much money they're going to throw at this and if it's going to be any good. But yeah, I want this again. Now, all those words I said in a jumble. Can you not want this?
I mean, I only really needed Heist to be like, okay. But everything else just
makes it sound that much better. Train heist. We love a good train story. We love a good heist story.
Led by a hot 25-year-old rebel who is dead set on freeing his province from the yoke of a brutal warlord. Like, yes, daddy, take me. Yes, whoever. I guess he wouldn't be daddy because he's younger than me at this point. But, you know, like a hot new like Chinese talent coming up, you know, play a revolutionary. I love that shit.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on this for sure. But moving on to our last story of this episode. In other adaptation news, independent studio Whip has optioned the rights for the TV/film adaptation of Babel, which is a novel by R.F. Kuang.
Yeah.
It is a fantasy dark academia novel that takes place in an alternate history version of Oxford in the 1800s, where magic exists, and that magic is studied at the Royal Institute of Translation, or Babel, where they utilize the energies obtained through the translation of colonized languages to English to power the British Empire. And so the story follows a kid named Robin Swift, who is a brilliant Chinese orphan who is adopted by one of the professors at Babel and is accepted into Babel as a translator, where he is quickly immersed in the enchanting world of imperial academia, but is also exposed to the Institute's dark underbelly. And eventually those tensions come to a head and Robin has to make the moral decision of whether to continue living his life of privilege in return for using his newfound abilities in service of the Institute's imperialistic goals, or to stand up and fight against the very system that raised him. So it explores themes of like growing up under imperialism and colonization and how empires, you know, weaponize things like language and culture, all wrapped up in the vibes of a dark academia story. So do we want this?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. I find that her background is like so interesting that she like, you know, writing these fiction novels, but like she's also like getting her PhD in like both languages. Like she studied at all these like intent, like very like ivory tower institutions. So I'm just going to take Babel as like nonfiction. Well, and this is what this is actually what like fuels the empire. And I'm also just like a fucking like word nerd, like etymology nerd. Mm-hmm. So anything mm-hmm. in that like realm, like I find very fascinating. And again, maybe we can get more hot people on screen. So yes for me all around.
Yeah. I mean, Rebecca, the author, the inspiration for this story came when she was studying at Oxford for her, I think she was doing her master's there. And basically there were these two statues of like these very serious looking white dudes in the library staring at her while she was studying. And that kind of
look, I think at a time when media literacy is so low, we need like explicit popular texts that are like just blatantly like imperialism bad. Don't do it, because apparently Dune went over everyone's fucking head. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would love that. I would love the story of anti-imperialism and, you know, those themes to be centered around a person of color.
Yeah.
More often than, you know, like a white stand-in for that. So yeah, that's all good to me.
Yeah, and bonus is Robin also has feelings for his Indian best friend.
Yes.
great.
Yeah, I read this novel. It was probably one of the big ones for that year. For me.
I mean, this one huge in like mm-hmm. book talk, which is funny because I feel like media literacy isn't the best sometimes in book talk. Definitely a lot of people loved it for the vibes, and
yes
like Dune, the messages went over their heads.
You know,
it is what it is.
Yeah, sometimes you give them the broccoli and then they just chase the cheese, but yeah, that's fine. I if it gets made, because the other thing is it's like kind of like what you were getting, Jess, was that, you know, she is an academician and this is sort of like an academic sort of like wonderland. So I'm ready for all the nerdiness. I'm ready for the footnotes and see how that they translate it to the screen. I'm ready for all of that stuff. I'm very curious to see how this gets adapted.
I mean, dark academia is a very popular genre.
Yeah.
People love a good school story.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. And not just for uniforms.
But and, definitely, you know, hopefully
maybe it'll lead to like more of her work getting. I'm sure her work is already optioned, but like, you know, like things like Poppy War, even Yellowface.
Yeah.
Like maybe that will, you know, if this is successful, it'll open the doors to like move those projects along too.
I feel like Yellowface is her most recent book. And that one, I want to say, is already like, that's got to be optioned somewhere. Yellowface is such a fun work because it totally calls out the publishing industry. And it's kind of, again, like the things she's talking about, it's kind of like the call is coming from inside the house sometimes with like the promotion of that book, because it's like the publishing industry is lauding this book about the publishing industry being terrible to authors of color.
Yeah. My question for you, Marvin, though, is like they haven't really confirmed whether it's going to be a series or a film. What do you want it to be?
I can see it as a trilogy of movies or a limited series. I would prefer a limited series because I feel like this story needs more than 10 hours to like really be told well.
Yeah. We haven't had good track records with like fantasy film adaptations. You usually get the one and it's like did not work or no one came to watch it and then it kind of dies in the water. So
yeah.
Yeah. I could see this being like a prestige series, hopefully.
Yeah, and the studio that optioned it previously worked on The Mayor of Easttown and The Summer I Turned Pretty, which I think is a good sign because I know that Jenny Han had a lot of creative input in The Summer I Turned Pretty. Right. And so hopefully this also means that Rebecca will be able to have an active role in the adaptation, because you know, the one fear that we all have when our favorite books are being adapted is that it gets hijacked by the showrunner, right?
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. It's still a little early, but yes, fingers crossed.
Yeah. Let's hope it gets to the production stage and we actually get to see it.
Yeah, well, that was our last story, so that'll do it for this edition of Do We Want This? Thank you so much for listening. Before we go, though, Jess Han, if you want to find out more of your thoughts, where can they go?
My trash takes are on Twitter at JessJuTweets.
And I am everywhere at Hanonymous.
You can find me on the internet at Marvin Yu. You can find our show at Good Pop Club. We are, as always, a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective. And check out our fellow Asian American hosted podcast by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. And yeah, that's Do We Want This for the month of March. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you all next time on Good Pop. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
We're still here, and we're going strong.
It's an exciting time in Asian America. There are more movies, TV shows, books, and music reflecting us than ever. But all of these represent just a small slice of Asian American culture and experiences. So what do? Tell more slices. Asian Americana is a show that explores these slices of distinctly Asian American culture and history. We've talked about how Chinese Americans built California's Sacramento Delta, the art scene turns gallery institution giant robot, a play that explores the lost Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s, and, of course, Boba, just to name a few stories. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or on your podcast app.